Russell's observation about how there was a few years in a row there where December was a month of dying, death, for those in this congregation. And I wholeheartedly agree that the best way that we can honor their memories is by being faithful to our Lord. Because He's the one who gives us hope that defeats death, that overcomes death itself. So, very mindful of that in the month of December, even yet. And also, let me express appreciation to those who have been preaching in my absence. It's been a while since I've preached a sermon. I was looking over my calendar and going, wow. Whether, you know, because of Sierra Leone and then visiting preachers and prayer services, I've been back for a while, but just haven't had the opportunity to present a lesson. And so I'm looking forward to doing that this morning as well. Regardless of our physical athletic abilities, I think we can all appreciate and get excited about a race that we happen to be watching in the moment. Maybe not as much the beginning of a race, although that can be exciting, especially if it's a short race, but certainly at the finish line, that there's excitement in that. Races, like all created things, have beginnings and ends. And in a race, while the start is absolutely essential, the finish is the climax. And to begin a race and to stop short of the finish line is sad. It's anticlimactic. It's to fail to finish. And stories of runners failing to finish races are numerous. On December 2nd, 2012, Abel Mutai of Kenya, who had been an Olympic bronze medalist in the 3,000-meter steeplechase earlier that year, was decisively winning a race that he was running in northern Spain when he suddenly slowed his run, believing he had just crossed the finish line. He had not. Due to language barrier and no doubt crowd noise that is always in a fever pitch at that point in a race, he was confused and stopped short of the finish line. For a runner, there's probably nothing more disappointing or embarrassing. I mean, the whole point of a race is to finish. In the New Testament, there are three texts which employ our familiarity with running a race as a metaphor for life. That tells us that running races was a common practice even back in New Testament times. And of course, we're familiar with the fact that the Olympics are very ancient and that there were other competitions such like. Maybe that's not as much true for us, although I tend to think that most people are still pretty familiar with the concept of running a race. So as the end of this year draws near, I want to especially pay attention to the finish line. Because for anyone running a race, the finish line is what it's all about. Even Jesus observed that if one does not finish what he starts, it's the common practice of people to mock him for his inability to finish. And Jesus wasn't saying that was a good thing to do, to mock people. That's what people are going to do. You didn't finish what you started. In that case, he was talking about someone building a tower. But the concept is the same. You want to finish. So let's look at those three passages this morning. The first one is 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And again, keep in mind the time of year we're in. Those who have finished their races that we just made reference to. And about the end of the year itself. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24. Paul writes, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things," or self-controlled in all things. "Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." What I'm going to do with each of the three texts that we're going to look at this morning, we're going to look at the text itself, what I just read, but I'm going to suggest to you that there are things that precede it and that follow it in each of these running illustrations that are interesting to consider. But let's first understand the metaphor as it is used here. Talk about facts, about races that we might see in the Olympics or something like that, carnal races. All run, but only one wins the prize. That's what's true of carnal races. And those who compete in those races to win exercise self-control in everything, all aspects of their lives. Running isn't just showing up for the race that day and running it and being done. You will lose. You will lose to those who exercise self-control, who were thinking of the race long before the race ever started. And what they win is perishable. Okay, this is what's true of carnal races. All run, one wins. Those who compete, trying to win, exercise self-control, and what they win is perishable. So here, Paul then makes an application of what we sometimes call the lesser to the greater. Okay? So he's using a lesser thing, just an ordinary race, to illustrate and make some points about something greater. We are running, for example, to obtain an imperishable crown. Okay? That's the major distinction between these two things. What you win as a prize in a carnal race is perishable. It's going to get lost, get melted down, get deteriorate in one way or another. The race we're running, the prize is imperishable. That means it will not perish. Therefore, his point is, we of all people who are engaged in that race should all the more not run with uncertainty, but with confidence. Not in ourselves, but in God. And to that end, we do discipline ourselves. We bring our bodies into subjection with the goal of running and finishing well. The question is, do we do that? And I'm looking out over this audience, and I'm not seeing anybody that I know of who is an avid runner. I don't know how well this illustration is going to work, but maybe you've tried it before, or maybe you've known those who have been avid runners. I know many. If they are really going to compete so as to win, have a realistic opportunity of winning, they are going to exercise self-control, self-discipline in their lives. They're going to eat right. They're going to exercise right. They're going to train. They're going to do hard things. They're going to put their body through difficult things, and maybe that's one of the reasons none of us here run. We've tried it. Maybe we've never tried it, but that's not for us, because we know that to be good at it requires self-discipline, and self-discipline takes time and effort, and do I want to go through all the pain for that? We add up all the equation, we go, no. And so we don't run. But he's using that as an illustration for a race that we are all in. You might say, oh, I didn't sign up for that. No, you didn't. You were born and you're here and now you're in a race. You want to win? Then you're going to have to exercise self-control. You're going to have to exercise discipline. But I want us to consider also, as we're looking at this comparison that Paul makes to a carnal race, he makes a carnal race to our lives, that the potential failure. For a physical runner, it's that you won't be the one to win. Because that's what you're trying to be. In a race, all run, but only one wins. And so in that carnal race, I want to be that one to win. But for the spiritual runner, it is that we might be disqualified somehow. That's the potential failure. That we might be disqualified because we did not practice what we preached, for example. We said we were one thing. We said we were a Christian, but we didn't walk. We didn't follow Christ. Failing to live lives of faith that work and exercise self-discipline will lead to not crossing the finish line. It is not only one who wins. Were we in a race, to use the different word race, in the human race, all of us running, and only one wins, who is that? What human wins if there's only one who wins? Jesus Christ. He wins. We all lose. But guess what? It's not that kind of race. We win if we follow Jesus across the finish line. That's God's grace. We can all be winners. In a carnal race, all run, but one wins. In this race, we win if we follow the winner, and that's Jesus Christ. But that requires self-discipline. By God's grace, we can all win by following Jesus, looking to him, and imitating him. Now, let's look at the greater context of this. We just jumped right into the middle. You might know it, not know that, but we just jumped right into the middle of a larger conversation that he uses this illustration in. So, this idea of self-discipline versus disqualification. Is this for personal gain? We all understand that self-discipline is exercised for the salvation and long-term betterment of self. But that is not the context in which Paul makes this observation. He's not talking about you need to be better self-disciplined so you'll be a better person. That is true, but that's not what he's talking about here. Self-discipline is not only about resisting the temptation to cheat or to sin in some way. It is for the gospel's sake. Verse 23. Just before we began reading it, verse 24 before, it says, now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. With you. Paul says, with you. He's writing to the saints in Corinth. And so, one of the reasons that we exercise self-discipline is not only for ourselves, it's for others that we do that. In the preceding sections, and we don't have time to go there and read those, and we want to get on to our other few verses, Paul has admonished saints over and over again to exchange carnal attitudes, worldly attitudes that they have towards their liberties that they have in Jesus Christ for a sacrificial attitude towards those freedoms. That's in basically chapters 8 through 10. And this text that we read is right in the middle of that. Those who run in a race exercise self-control in all things including in those things that are not wrong, what we might sometimes refer to as liberties. We have a freedom to do that. I have the right to do that. I can do that. I can do that and still be pleasing to God. But we still exercise self-control in those things as does a physical runner in his race. It's not wrong for a physical runner to have a chocolate milkshake. There might even be a time for that chocolate milkshake. But you don't just live on chocolate milkshakes if you're going to be a winner who runs. You exercise self-control. And Paul brings up this idea, this concept, in the midst of talking about the liberties that we have in Jesus Christ. Knowledge is a wonderful thing to have. But without love, it can be anything from arrogant to rude to abusive. And so I might know something intellectually, and therefore I have the freedom to do X, whatever it is that you want to do, but not give consideration to whether or not I ought to do X in this context or at this time or with these people. And just because I know that an idol is nothing, for example, that's what he talks about earlier, therefore I can eat meat sacrificed to idols, and that was true. But it leads to a snobbery that is not considerate of the consciences of other people. And so when knowledge produces this intellectual and philosophical snobbery that despises and is apathetic toward those who don't know, who aren't as enlightened, it no longer edifies. It is destructive. And indeed, without the characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit, like love and self-control, knowledge becomes a very dangerous thing in the hands of those who don't love and who don't exercise self-control. And so again, to know that an idol is nothing, and therefore eating meat sacrificed to it is nothing, not only created a stumbling block for those without such knowledge, but without self-control, it was extrapolated into going so far as to share in things from which we ought to flee, that are sinful. And in this same context, chapter 6 through 10, he tells the disciples to flee fornication and to flee idolatry. And that's going to take the self-control in a culture in which idolatry is so prevalent, or in which fornication is so prevalent. Paul, as an apostle personally, had the right to do many things which he gave up to discipline himself that he might better serve the cause of the gospel and save others. And that is what is in the immediately preceding context to this text that we've looked at this morning. For Paul to become all things to all men that he might save some required self-discipline and it required sacrifice. Two things that in general Americans abhor. And probably not just Americans. I just happen to be one. Discipline that enables us, however, to finish requires a willingness to give up our rights, to give up our freedoms for the sake of the gospel and others who might benefit from it. And then following this section that we just read, he immediately in chapter 10 gives the example of the nation of Israel as they came out of Egyptian bondage. He wants us to finish well. Paul wants us to finish well. That's why he's used the race illustration. Not like Israel in the wilderness. So immediately following this admonition of self-discipline is a warning using the example of the generation of Israelites who failed to enter the promised land. You know that story. And so in verses 1 through 12 there, we say, we've got this elaborate illustration, this parallel, this analogy, if you will, to the children of Israel coming out and him making and tying in things that relate to us as Christians. And he's making the consistent observation there that they did not enter in the promised land, that their corpses fell in the wilderness because they did not have endurance, because they did not exercise self-control, because they gave themselves up to idolatry and things like that. And he says there in verse 12, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Chapter 10, verse 12. He's using Israel as an example to Christians. And we have the same potential of not finishing the race, of falling. We all have the same beginnings in Christ, but we need to take heed lest we fall. Israel was an example so that we do not fall as they did. Strong desires distracted them. They distract us. And if we allow them to distract us, we may not finish. Idolatry is elevating anything to greater importance than God and his will. What is that in your life? It's not bowing down to some stone image. I know that. We're Americans. We have knowledge. We're enlightened. We don't do that kind of silly stuff. But what is it that we bow down to? What is it that dominates our time and our resources? What are those tempting things? Those are the potential idols in our lives. Sexual immorality, rampant in our country, rampant in the world. This was a distraction to them. It is a distraction to us. Or testing Jesus Christ by complaining. That's what they did in the wilderness, right? We get tired of reading about how frequently they complain. But what do we do? A lot of complaining. Be careful. All of those things distract us. We need to be more self-disciplined in our lives. All right, let's go on to another text. 2 Timothy chapter 4. In verse 6. And again, there's a lot more that could be brought out in each of these contexts. We're trying to hit all three of these. 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning with verse 6, Paul writes, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." The end was near for Paul. I have finished the race. That, he says, in conjunction with having fought the fight and kept the faith. The past tense you see in all of those, it's not used literally here by Paul, but to convey imminence. It is going to happen soon. All right? That's why he uses the past tense. Unlike that racer that I mentioned at the beginning, Abel Mutai from Kenya, he is not thinking that he had literally crossed the finish line. Paul's not saying, "I have finished the race." No, Paul, you haven't. Literally, keep running. But that it was in sight, and he had every intention to finish in faith. He's just speaking that positively. It's like the prophetic past tense that we sometimes refer to. And when the prophet would speak of something as already being done, something that was actually in process, but it was already done. Like, they had conquered the land. "God, I have given you the land," God said to Joshua. Wait a minute, they hadn't marched around Jericho yet, they hadn't conquered it yet. "I have given you the land." Prophetic past tense, it's done. It's as good as done, is the way we might put it today. Paul's statement is in agreement with the present tense. "I am already being poured out." Okay? There he talks in the present tense. "And the time of my departure is at hand," is what he said. You have to understand his past tenses here in the context in which he presents them. What does a runner do when he sees the finish line nearing? If he correctly identifies the finish line, what does he do? Does he quit? No, the finish line encourages him. He's going to run all the harder. He's going to give all that he has. all that he has left. And that varies depending on the length of the race. It is harder than when he started the race. Yes, you're near the finish line. It's harder. But if there is no finish, then the start was in vain. You want to finish. You want to finish as strong as possible. And so he refers to here that there's this crown of righteousness. A crown here is not the diadem that we oftentimes think of on a king's head. It's the laurel wreath that you might have seen from the ancient Olympic Games that were given to the winners. The laurel wreath of the victorious one. Righteousness, this crown of righteousness, that's the state of being conveyed to those who have loved the appearing of the Lord. That's what we are in. If we love the appearing of the Lord, we are looking forward, hastening the coming of the day of the Lord, then righteousness is the state that we are in. Victory is only found in Jesus, and he will crown all who have followed him. Isn't that great? He will crown everyone who followed him across that finish line. So real quick, just a quick application this time from the greater context, the things surrounding this, these few verses. In verses 1 through 5, you have Paul's exhortation to Timothy, a younger preacher, the younger generation. Preach, be ready, convince, rebuke, exhort with what? All long-suffering and teaching. Long-suffering. That's what's needed in a race. Endurance. Be watchful, endure, do, fulfill. Those are the verbs that are used in this immediate context. That's what leads up to this idea of Paul saying, I have finished the race. This is how he has behaved. This is how his life has been since he became a Christian. And this is how he wants the next generation to run as well. But there's a warning in the section following, verses 9 through 18 there. Be diligent, he says to Timothy. Don't quit as others have. And he cites some specific examples of people who quit the race, who did not finish. And then makes the observation that it's Jesus who strengthens, Jesus who delivers. Jesus is the one who enables us to win, who enables us to cross that finish line, who enables us to even be in the race. And then one more text that I want us to look at in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, the first two verses. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He says, let us, that is those who were reading this letter, like we are this morning, let us lay aside every weight. One of the things he tells us to do. Lay aside every weight. What is that weight? In this context, it's the sin which so easily ensnares us. Lay those things aside. We want nothing that will impede our run. Lay aside those things. If you're a runner in a race, you want to minimize the amount of things that you're carrying, the weights. In this case, the weights are sin. Get rid of those. And then he says, let us run with endurance. The implication of endurance is the reality of unpleasant, uncomfortable, or otherwise difficult circumstances which could discourage some from finishing what they started. You don't need endurance for things that don't require anything of you. that don't require any effort, that don't require any sacrifice or suffering or anything like that. You don't need endurance. But if we're told to endure, then there's something we're putting up with that is uncomfortable, that is discouraging. He says, do it. Endure. Run with endurance. As I said before, the race gets harder the longer it goes. And so thus, endurance is required all the more the longer we're in the race. Endurance requires motivation. There's got to be some sort of motivation or you will quit. You will quit. The motivation isn't sufficient. The motivation to have a gold medal and stand on that tri-stand at the Olympics and have the crowd applaud was not motivating to me. So I didn't race. I didn't run. It wasn't of interest to me. I wasn't motivated. Paul's using this running illustration, and it may not work real well for some of us because none of us are runners, at least not competitive runners, not self-disciplined runners, but we are runners is what Paul's telling us, in a different kind of race. So what is the motivation? Without faith and hope, there's no reason to endure. You got to have some sort of hope, some sort of confidence. So what does he tell us to do? Look to Jesus. Looking unto Jesus. What do we see when we look unto Jesus? We see that he endured the cross in order to sit at the right hand of God's throne. And that he is the author and the perfecter of our faith, by which we can please God and enjoy his reward. You remember that from chapter 11 and verse 6 of Hebrews. If we're going to come to God, we've got to believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. You've probably seen images in movies or stills of runners crossing the finish line. And there is pain on their faces. Grimaces. Effort being made to cross that finish line. They're being motivated by prestige, prominence, a medal. What are we being motivated by? Jesus and the hope that he offers. Why would Jesus do what he did on the cross? What did Jesus say as he hung on the cross? It is finished. His efforts on our behalf were complete, save for the resurrection from the dead. So again, application from the greater context. We've just chosen these two verses out of chapter 12, but you know chapter 11 that leads right up to this. Examples of faith. That's what he's referring to in verse 1 of chapter 12. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, the cloud of witnesses include the named and many unnamed people of faith who have run the race before us. And now they're sitting in the stands watching us enter the stadium after that long marathon, approaching the finish line. And so their lives of faith are intended in part to motivate us to finish. Their faith was not simply some internal conviction, but such that it motivated them to act, to do, to obey, to wait, to sacrifice, to bless, to refuse sin, to forsake the world, to endure trials. It motivated them to do all those things. We're supposed to learn from them. And in chapter 10 and verse 36, which just immediately precedes these examples in chapter 11, the writer says, "For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise." What do we need, brethren? We need endurance. And then what are the admonitions that follow this little section that we read in chapter 12? That we are to consider Jesus, verse 3, "For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself." And that's what we're here this morning to do, is to consider Jesus. That's what the Lord's Supper is all about, that we're thinking about Jesus, and we eat his body and we drink his blood, and that's gross on a very surface level, but that represents Jesus' endurance for us. And so we need to also, as he goes on to talk about, endure God's discipline. We're going through trials. We're going through difficulties. The older we get, the more we have, physically especially. But there's still the emotional and other issues and the concerns about other people. They just keep mounting. And that's God's discipline. And if we don't have that, we don't have a care in the world. And we don't have a father who's disciplining us. These things that we go through are God's discipline to form us into what he wants us to be. And we need to endure that discipline, not just complain about it like the children of Israel did in the wilderness. What was God doing? What was God thinking? He was disciplining them so that they might become the people that he wanted them to be. So we need to endure God's discipline and appreciate God's discipline. We had fathers who disciplined us, and we appreciate that in general. As an adult, we look back and appreciate that. So all the more, God's discipline is the argument of the writer here. And then, as he goes on to talk even further, verse 12, "Therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, rather be healed. Strengthen and pursue with diligence." The whole idea of this is diligence. So as we wrap things up, the race we are running is not a competition against one another. That's another thing that sets it apart from the carnal races that are being used as an illustration here. We are all in a common struggle against sin and the father of lies who seeks to weigh us down and get us to quit. That's what Satan wants. He wants us to quit. And he will do anything to keep us from finishing. That's his chief aim. He does not want us to finish this race. How do we feel about those that we are running the race with? You want the person in the pew next to you or behind you or in front of you to finish? Brethren, that's what I want. I want you to finish. I want you to finish strong. I want you to finish well. I want to encourage you to do that. Huh? I did not tell you the rest of the story of Abel Mutai's race in Spain. He was so far in the lead that no one could have caught him if he had not stopped too soon. Indeed, the man in second place was a Spaniard, remember they're running in Spain, who immediately figured out what had happened, and he quickly caught up with him. But instead of passing him, he stayed behind him and gestured and guided the Kenyan to the finish line and victory. Of course, this was not common behavior in a race. And he was interviewed by many after the race. Not the winner, the guy who came in second place. "I did what I had to do," said Ivan Fernandez Anaya. "He was the rightful winner. He created a gap that I couldn't have closed if he hadn't made a mistake. And as soon as I saw he was stopping, I knew I wasn't going to pass it." Spaniard's coach observed, it was a very good gesture of honesty, a gesture of the kind that isn't made anymore, or rather of the kind that has ever been made, a gesture that I myself wouldn't have made. I certainly would have taken advantage of it to win. And the coach added, the gesture has made him a better person, but not a better athlete. He has wasted an occasion. Winning always makes you more of an athlete. You have to go out to win. So it would seem that some deem athleticism of greater value than being a better person. It would appear that two different worldviews were exemplified in this story. The second place Spanish runner said, quote, my dream is that someday we can have a kind of community life. But what would be the merit of my victory? What would be the honor of that medal? What would my mom think of that? Isn't that wonderful? From whence did he get this idea of some kind of community life that would be wonderful like that? Where did that idea originate? Not with him. Not with the philosophers of this world. That's what God wanted with Adam and Eve in the garden. And that's why Jesus died on the cross. He sacrificed so that we could win. In the survival of the fittest world from which we've supposedly evolved, does that kind of thing happen? No. That's why the coach, who I suspect is a firm believer in survival of the fittest, presuming that that runner wasn't smart enough to know where the finish line was, would have taken advantage of that. Does the community life, the idea of community life that this guy talked about, come from the idea of survival of the fittest that atheism promotes, or in a world created by God? You know the answer. And whether acknowledged or not, that kind of community life that so many people are desiring, that dream is a reality in the context of Jesus Christ. You try to do it in the context of something else, there's people still want it, but they don't want it through God. They want to have some sort of community life, not survival of the fittest. They want to have some sort of community life, but they won't acknowledge the one who gave them that sense, that desire to have that community life. And that's Jesus Christ. We are running the race, and we want to see all finish well. So let's live our lives looking unto Jesus and help others finish that race, win, and be victorious. And let's think about all those things while together we partake of the Lord's Supper after we sing number 285.